This is Nancy Amerson on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library's Oral History Program. I'm here in the Mill Valley Library's recording studio on October 18th, 2017, with Lori Cohen. She's a Mill Valley resident with a unique contribution to our town. She's a Millie Award winner and is well known as the founding artistic director of the Mill Valley Philharmonic. Welcome, Lori.
Thanks, Nancy. Glad to be here.
I'm so glad we can add your oral history to our collection. Are you ready to begin?
Yeah, I'm honored that you want to.
Absolutely. So will you start with where and when you were born?
Yes, I was born in San Francisco in 1947. Lived there until I went to college. And my parents, I had a number of parents, but my father and mother had five children, and we all grew up there in Pacific Heights. And my father died, and my mother remarried. And eventually she remarried again to someone who brought two stepsisters into our family. So we're a family of seven siblings.
Wow, big family.
Big family.
Now, yeah.
Big Thanksgiving celebrations for sure.
Did you go to elementary school in the Pacific Heights area?
Yes, I started at Grant School, which no longer exists, which was a public elementary school. And then my parents put me in Hamlin School until eighth grade. Then I went to Berks, which then had a high school.
That was a girls' school, right?
They were both girls' schools.
Oh, okay.
So I graduated from Berks, yeah.
Did being in an all-girls school influence your life?
Yes. And, in fact, I went to a women's college. I went to Sarah Lawrence, which became co-ed while I was there, but the co-ed aspect of it only included about six men when I was there.
They were on the vanguard of
Yes, they were. They were on the vanguard. Yes, I mean, definitely influenced my life. I really think that I would have done a lot better in a public school and in a co-ed school. It was interesting when I had my own child, and he went through all the public schools in Mill Valley. That gave me a chance to actually have some public school life, which was really valuable to me. It was great.
Is there a particular aspect of public schools that you missed or that you thought was valuable?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Feel like the diversity of people economically, racially, and all of that is really lacking in the schools that I went to. Wow. On the other hand, growing up in San Francisco when I did, my mother at that time mostly was an artist, although she did a million things. She was very active in starting the neighborhood arts program in San Francisco. She was very socio-politically involved and did a number of really fabulous, fabulous things in terms of social progress. And so they were very progressive in Pacific Heights, which was often very conservative. And they gave us, as children, the run of the city. Their whole thing was get on a bus. And that was fantastic. It was really great.
Do you think that that openness to letting you experience the city was a progressive trait, or was it?
Yeah. I mean, yes, I definitely do. Mm-hmm. I think that they wanted us to be independent, and they valued all different kinds of experiences. So, yes, I think it was progressive.
Your childhood sounds like it was maybe not ideal, since I don't know a lot about it, but at least...
I don't know what an ideal childhood is, but it was a really amazing childhood in that we had artists of all kinds in the house all the time. That was really exciting. There were also people who were involved in social movements that were also... I met the most amazing people. It was really terrific. And it was ideal in the sense that my siblings and I were really close, and we remain really close. Several of them live in Mill Valley, in fact.
Wow, that's pretty unusual. You socialize together, spend lots of time together and have those big Thanksgiving dinners, that sort of thing.
It's at my house this year.
All right. Great. Well, you told us that you went to Sarah Lawrence. How did that come about, and how did it go while you were there?
Well, it was mixed. My mother actually was a trustee. I think if... I've thought about this often. I think I would have been much better suited to go to someplace like Berkeley, to Cal, but that was way too close to home for me. So I needed to get away from home. I think, you know, like a lot of 17-year-olds, I didn't know, you know, much. I didn't know much. That's it. Once I got there, it was a really good education. All of the classes were seminar classes, but it was also a fishbowl in the sense that when you, especially as a freshman and sophomore, when you have those really small classes, there's a little too much exposing of oneself, I think, both intellectually and emotionally. And when that is being led by a professor, and many of the professors were men, I think that it's not the perfect kind of education for... On the other hand, you know, I learned a lot. I got extremely politically involved. I was very much on the cusp. I graduated in 69. I was very involved in the anti-war movement, very involved in the feminist movement. And when I was a junior, I moved into New York, which was just a half an hour away by train, took a number of independent studies at NYU, and then also independently on my own. And so, you know, that provided a different kind of milieu and a different kind of education that was very useful to me.
Where exactly is Sarah Lawrence?
It's in Bronxville, which is a half an hour away by train from me.
So it seems like moving into New York City off campus, I suppose, or away from the campus, that also expanded your...
Oh, for sure.
Your neighborhood, you know.
That said, I also spent a lot of time in the city going to museums, and I started out studying, being focused more on visual art, and actually ended up that way at Sarah Lawrence as well, having directed myself towards, kind of self-directed myself towards animation. So then when I graduated... Really by pull, I have to say. I got a job at a small studio, the Hubley Studio, and worked there for a year. As a gopher, but also I got to do backgrounds and some animation. It was good. It's a good job.
So your degree led you to animation, or? Was actually
no,
in animation was, or I, graphic arts or?
You know, you didn't have to really graduate in anything from Sarah Lawrence, so it's a different kind of education system.
I see.
Yes, my focus was visual art.
Okay. But you were with the studio for 1 year.
Yes.
And then something must have happened because you moved on.
Well, I was still intensely politically involved, and I became really upset by and overwhelmed by the amount of violence that was beginning to happen in the anti-war movement. So, you know, if I was participating in a demonstration in Washington, and the police would come by and shoot their elephant guns into the glass windows behind you, or some of the interactions when we were going to military bases, and that it was it just became overwhelming to me because I'm not a violent person at all. So I and some friends, I guess, yeah, decided that we want. I mean, this is kind of self-serving and sophomoric, even though we were graduated. that we would practice personal politics by starting a commune. So that's what we did.
Was that radical at the time?
Was it a radical commune or was it a radical move?
Both.
It was, again, we were just on the cusp. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember R. Crum, the cartoonist, but I pretty much fit one of his cartoon women. It was pretty funny, actually, at the time. Anyway, just, you know, very politically involved, very... I mean, I have to say that even growing up in a city in San Francisco, I always had a pull towards rural living. So in some ways, it wasn't that much of a jump. Mostly what we did was we just gathered a bunch of friends together and started a farm. And
this was not New York City, though, I'm thinking.
No. This is in Vermont.
Okay.
So, yes, one of my best friends from college lived in Putney, Vermont. And so we traveled around Vermont and looked for land and found it in a pretty funny way. But I'm not sure it's worth the time to go into.
How many friends did this together?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe 10 of us, 8 or 10 of us starting out. And then the vagaries of commune life kind of split us apart when people started going, you know, actually, you know, we're in our early 20s. I really want to become a doctor, you know, or I want to practice law, or, you know, I just can't stand the, you know, it's a really fun life, but it's not that easy a life to be self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. We were the
Which, did you have a? Did the commune have a focus? Was it raising sheep or was it just feeding yourself?
Feeding ourselves and basically, I think this informs my entire life: learning on the job. And I learned a ton. I have no regrets about that period of my life. I learned how to do carpentry. I later worked as a carpenter, actually, after I moved back to the Bay Area. I learned how to farm. I learned how to garden. I learned how to build all kinds of things. I learned how to operate in the snow. I learned how to operate tractors. I learned some mechanics. I could work on the tractors. I learned a lot. So,
And how long were you in this lifestyle?
I was there for almost 7 years. Not everybody was there for 7 years.
You saw some transition, probably people leaving and people coming in.
Yeah, and towards the end, there were very few of us there, just a few, a couple.
So how did it end?
The person who became my husband, his name is Mark. We didn't get married for another quite a while, but... And I both wanted to go to music school. music was an absolute through thread. It's probably the only true through thread in my life. I started playing when I was four, or it was recognized when I was four on the piano, mm-hmm. and just like played piano, then played guitar in college, picked up cello when I was 25. I mean, I just piano. I mean, just like music all the way through. So Mark and I decided we're both really interested in playing jazz. He's a bass player and a composer. And so we decided we wanted to go to Berklee College of Music. So in the meantime, I took some online classes that were offered by Berklee. I went to Middlebury, which was about 30 miles away, for some theory classes, which I didn't understand at all. Then Mark and I got into Berklee, and we went there for a year. It was amazing, an amazing music education.
I bet.
Probably, in some ways, the best music education I've had. Just opened my ears. I learned so much there. I was on guitar at that point. And we rented the farm to some friends of ours who did not actually take very good care of it. And then, that's all right. We're still kids, you know. But when we came back from Berklee, both of us decided that we really wanted to play jazz, and there really was not much available to us in Vermont. And also, if we were going to focus on that, it was going to be hard to run a farm. And he was not a farmer, by the way. but so we started trying to figure out where we wanted to go. Should we go to New York? Should we go to Boston? Back to Boston? Let's go to the Bay Area, because my family's here. It's a big enough city that, you know, or there are big enough cities around that there'll be opportunities to play. But in the meantime, you know, in order to sell the farm, I had put up, I'd say, 95% of the money to buy the farm in the first place. I had to survey it. So this piano playing friend of mine, his father is it an entomologist that's the bug person, or an etymologist? Etymologist. I don't know, anyway.
But he was the bug person.
And so anyway, but he also knew how to survey. So he and I surveyed it. And what we had bought as 140 acres turned out to be 180 acres. It was a fascinating experience. It took us months, you know, 3 months probably, to hack our way through the pulpwood, mm-hmm. and go through swamps and, you know, try and figure out from the town records, you know, like, oh, well, the northeast corner has a black oak on it, and that's the marker. Well, there aren't black oaks in Vermont, so it was really, really interesting trying to piece it all together. But we did it.
And you collected another skill.
Yeah, I know it's not a skill I'd go back to, but he was such an interesting person, and it was pretty fabulous to spend the day with him hacking through the forests and the swamps and trying to figure it all out. It was so interesting. So anyway, so then Mark and I decided to move to the Bay Area. Within a year, we bought the house in Mill Valley, in Tam Valley. So I've been there for, I don't know, 41 years, 42 years. Same house.
So are we talking about 1976
or so? You know, I don't know, somewhere around there. And, yeah.
Can I ask you, you came back to the Bay Area. You had grown up in San Francisco. How did you know about Mill Valley or Marin, or how did you get to Mill Valley?
One of the ways that, well, I wanted to live somewhere where I could have a garden because that was really, really important to me. And again, I just, you know, I'm not crazy about city life. I don't like the noise. I don't like the asphalt. Mm-hmm. But part of one of my really early influences was from Clem and Posey Hurd, Clem Hurd being the illustrator for Goodnight Moon and Posey Hurd being a children's book writer, and their son Thatcher all lived up on the mountain. When we were kids and, you know, growing up, my parents and the Herds would get together almost, I mean, I swear it was so many weekends, and go up on Mount Tam, go have a picnic, go on a hike. So many weekends we would do that, and Sundays. And it was just, so I had a real connection. And also because the Herds had a place in Vermont, which I visited, actually, wonderful place, amazing place. There was even more of a connection. So, yeah. So it wasn't that Mill Valley, per se, was going to be our focus of a place to live. But, I mean, all the advantages of Mill Valley, especially at that time, lots of musicians still lived here. Lots of kind of woodsy cabin living still existed. It's close to the city, you know, close to my family.
So,
seemed like a good thing.
Yeah, it sounds like you didn't come to Mill Valley with the intention of staying for 41 years, but you did.
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, I don't know how much of a idea we had of an infinite future.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm. And you were playing music, so you had to travel around the Bay Area probably to different venues.
Yeah. I mean, actually what happened was I spent many years trying to, trying to be a professional guitarist and finally gave up, which is fine, because there were other things in between and around and through. So, but it was really difficult. And partly it was really difficult as a woman, a female guitarist, you know, dealing with club owners, and it doesn't pay. So it's pretty hard.
You have to have another job or another form of income.
Yeah. At the same time, my ex-husband, I can't remember what year. Well, probably in 77, he joined the Pickle Family Circus. So he was in the band and very quickly became the music director of the Pickle Family Circus band. And so he was, you know, he was doing okay. Not great, but he was doing okay. He had a steady job.
Now, let's see if we're going.
This was maybe around 77, 78.
This was about the same time you had your son, thinking.
No, so I had we had our child in 79.
Okay, so coming up to
that. His name's Miles.
Miles.
So let's see. So Miles was born, and then when Miles was, and we took Miles on the road with us. So I was on the road with the Pickles a lot. Had Miles in a basket. The mode was, you know, if you were on the road, you stayed in tents wherever you were. So Miles grew up somewhat in a tent, which is great.
And how far did the Pickle Family Circus travel?
The farthest I ever went with them was to Alaska, and that's when Miles was about 6 weeks old, or maybe a little older. maybe a little older.
Did you drive or fly?
We flew from, I think we flew from Oregon or Seattle, came back through Seattle for the Bumper Shoot Festival, and then there are a lot of stops along the way. But there were other babies also in the circus who were born within 2 weeks of each other, which was kind of interesting. Anyway, when Miles was 20 months old, my husband left me. So then I became a single mother.
And not associated with the Pickle Family Circus, since that was his thing.
That was his thing. It ended up with me maintaining more friendships in the with the Pickles than he did. But that's kind of another story I don't want to really get into.
Okay.
He's friends with them now, and I'm friends with him, too.
But, oh, that's nice.
But really, until Miles was 13, I was definitely a single mother.
And just trying to support him, Miles, as a single mother? So were you still a musician at that point?
No. I mean, I still played music, but I went to graduate school and got a degree in, actually during that time, I also worked as a carpenter.
Yes.
But I went to graduate school in psychology with the intention of becoming a therapist, which I did become.
You went to graduate school in San Francisco?
No, at Dominican.
Dominican, okay. Mm-hmm. And that's a couple of years, right, to get that graduate degree?
It's actually quite a while. It takes quite a while because you have to do so many hours of internship, 3,000 hours of internship. It's a long haul. Mm-hmm. But then I set up a private practice. Eventually, my private practice was here in Mill Valley. And that lasted 20 years.
20 years.
Okay. It overlapped with some of the orchestra, my time in the orchestra. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And did you specialize in any particular kind of
therapy? I mean, it's primarily psychoanalytic, object relations-based therapy. I tended to see mostly in adults long-term, sometimes couples. I didn't see children.
Okay. And you continued, you did that full-time, I presume, or as full-time as you can when you're a mom.
I mean, it was, it was a substantial amount of time. It wasn't, 40 hours a week. I don't think anybody could stand that, or at least I certainly couldn't.
In that field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Too hard.
But you did it for 20 years, and then did you retire
from it? Yeah. I mean, I think what I did was because the orchestra got bigger and more successful and so forth, it was a full-time job for me. So I, as one does as a therapist, kind of titrated off for a couple of years and saw particular clients through, maybe a year and a half of ending. Mm-hmm. Endings, yeah.
So you phased out.
You phased
out.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you let your license lapse and so, yeah.
And it's in the past. You wouldn't go back and yep. retrieve that career.
Nope.
So that takes us to the Philharmonic, which right. is how most people probably know you in Mill Valley, at least now, maybe not 20 years ago, but
right.
So how did that come about?
Well, when my son, Miles, was in high school, I got very involved with the music department. He's a musician. He's a composer, producer in a music house, at a music house in Los Angeles. He was a drummer from the age of, as soon as he could pick up a pot and a pan. It was clear.
And you would be able to recognize that as a musician yourself.
I think I probably encouraged it. Uh-huh. I have a, a photograph of him in his red BVDs as a little tiny kid banging away. Pretty cute. Anyway, so when he was in high school, I got very involved with his music department. I got hired by the, whatever it's called, the education board.
School board.
School board, thank you, to be the liaison between Mill Valley Middle School and the high school to encourage kids to come into the music department, because at the time, Joan Diemer, who's my neighbor and excellent friend, was directing the musical theater department. And so more and more kids were interested in doing that. Excuse me, I'm going to sneeze, I think.
Go ahead. Don't cut this out.
You can't do it when somebody says go. No. Anyway, so a lot of kids wanted to go into the theater department rather than into the music department, even though Bob Greenwood had been so prominent and such a leader in the Tam High music department. Previously, kids wanted to play music. So I was hired as the liaison, and I spent a lot of time in Omar Clay's classroom. He was the music director there then, also a jazz drummer. He had a lot of influence on my son. I wonder if by this time Miles would have graduated. In any case, my thoughts were, I want to switch careers and become a high school music teacher. And so I started going in that direction by taking classes at San Francisco State. And the first two classes I had were in choral conducting and orchestral conducting. Not brilliantly taught, but as soon as I got on the podium, I realized that this was exactly what I wanted to do with my life. This was it. It was just the most amazing aha moment. I had no idea I wanted to conduct prior to that. No idea whatsoever. I think that actually that is what spurred me to get fully involved with Omar Clay's music direction there. I can't remember the timing exactly, but once I made that decision, I realized that what I need, because I was 50 years old, this was going to be like, oh my God, I'm 50, found a private instructor, and his name's Orr Steiner. He was the director of the orchestra at the San Francisco Community Music Center, and I was studying with him and then going into the orchestra rehearsals, and that also was just such a it's just sort of a miraculous experience where you open the doors into a dream you didn't know you had, you know, and you're surrounded by an orchestra full of musicians. And so I very quickly became the assistant conductor there. And he was really terrific. Urs was really fantastic in the sense that he would just hold my feet to the fire. You go, okay, you're going to conduct this. Oh, I'm not coming in. You're going to conduct the whole rehearsal. Like, what? You know that I'd be studying all night, studying scores. Like, how am I going to do this? I don't know how to do this. And I was there for 4 years. And a couple of years into it, saw that there wasn't an independent community orchestra in Marin County anywhere. There were bands, you know, there were the Sewer Band and the Corte Madera Town Band and that, but those are wind bands. So I just dove in, and I want to start an orchestra. We need one. The only other community orchestra was the one at College of Marin, and that's different because it's institutionally connected. So I basically twisted the arms of every string player I knew, some of whom I knew from taking chamber music classes at College of Marin. So that was great. I think we started out with 15, maybe, string players, and within a year had 35 people with woodwinds, and then expanded it some more, and it just kept, it was definitely work getting it to expand, but expanded it to a full orchestra that was able to play a much broader range of repertoire. And then along the way, I got really, really interested in programming. And I think, if anything, that's what I'm known for among my musician friends or musicians, and that's that I have a knack for programming interesting music.
So could you explain what programming is?
Sure. In order to have a concert, you have to choose music. And my interest is choosing music that people may be unfamiliar with, that music, that pieces that hang together possibly in a theme, but always in your ear. And I'm not really sure how to describe that, but it takes a fair amount of thought to, and it's a very enjoyable thought for me, to sort of a creative free zone for me, to kind of hear things in your ear so that they settle into a program that really makes sense, both to your ear and possibly thematically. So, for example, the first time I did that was maybe our second year as an orchestra, and that was something called Man and His Machines, and it involved all kinds of music that represented machines. That was kind of the start. And then it was Birdsong in 20th Century Music, and then it was, on and on. It was music from the 1930s that came about because of the Works Progress Administration. And we did that we actually did two series of those. One was in the presence of murals from the 1930s, including at TAM High School, where there was a mural project going on, because there are some great murals over there, as well as mosaics. The second series was in WPA Architectural Sites. So we played at the Exhibition Hall on Treasure Island and at the San Francisco Zoo and, places like that. I developed a script and had an actor friend of mine pretend he was, or act, however you say that, with a, kind of 1930s looking microphone, and he described what was going on in the music and what was going on in the 30s that would relate to that music. That's when I was really, really happy to, that was an exceptional one in my mind. Mm-hmm. But since then, there have been so many different ones, often involved, as were the murals project, WPA music, involved with other community organizations, which I find is really useful in kind of promoting our mutual, our mutual community involvement. And also it draws people in who might not otherwise even be interested in hearing orchestral music. So that's been really fun. We had stream keepers. We did a whole thing about water. The year before, I did one called Rain Dance, and we got the Marin Municipal Water District involved and had a Miwok Indian sing rain dance songs and brought all of this different kind of music together to sort of invoke the rains. And it worked.
And it worked. Thank you so much.
So there have been all kinds of things like that. It's really exciting to do that.
Is there a particular way you get your inspiration for these themes that you program to?
I think it's more, themes kind of come up. I think, let me just preface by saying, I think there's a huge danger in pandering to audiences by smashing stuff together that you think should go together. And you see it all the time. It's like, you just do.
Maybe without being specific, but is there an example of how that comes from being logical to being pandering?
I think if you come up with a theme first and then just try and smash a bunch of music into that idea, that can quickly become pandering. And it does often.
Okay. So you see that in other programs.
I do. And I know that any failures that I've had in thematic programming have certainly come from, I can't find the piece that I'm really looking for, so I'll use this piece. It just doesn't work. But where I get my inspiration, I do a lot of walking. My inspiration tends to come when my head is clear and not thinking. That's it.
As the founder and leader of the Philharmonic, is it one of the responsibilities you make yourself do to be thinking ahead? Okay, we have a program coming up in March, and I need to have my theme and my program mm-hmm. figured out. And then as soon as that gets close, I've got to be thinking about the next one.
Yeah, I try and program a year and a half in advance. But we're doing Valentine's concerts in February, and I am actually having some difficulty finding exactly what I want.
You still have some time, but
get on it.
But this is not your finale because...
No, I have a grand finale. My grand finale is Beethoven's Ninth, which has a huge amount of meaning for me because it was a piece of music that inspired me. My family is not musical. My parents, rather. Some of my siblings are. But it really inspired me when I was in high school. Then when I was in college, I had a German boyfriend whom I met in summer school, and he invited me to Berlin over Christmas. This was before the wall came down, obviously, but we went to East Berlin to hear the Berlin Philharmonic. It probably was directed by Karajan, and I'm sure it was New Year's Eve, so it's almost certain that it was Beethoven's Ninth. That's pretty amazing. I wish I could remember more clearly. Then when I, decades fall off the calendar, and when I was assistant conductor at the San Francisco Community Music Center, we did Beethoven's Ninth every year, and so I had a chance to study the score for 4 years and also play triangle in it, and which is actually not that easy a part, strangely.
But, okay.
So it has a lot of meaning in addition to its being a seminal, amazing piece of music. We're collaborating with the Dominican Chorus, what used to be the Winifred Baker Chorale, and the Throckmorton Chorus. And we have 4 soloists for the quartet, and it's going to be amazing.
And when is this?
May 19th and 20th.
Okay. We don't want to miss that. 2018.
Yep.
Okay, so you're thinking of your finale, or it sounds like you've got it managed. You need to, how did you decide to retire?
Well, one thing is that it's now been 18 years since I started the orchestra. I'm not just the artistic director. I'm the ED, basically.
ED, executive director.
Sorry, the executive director. So the bigger and the more successful the orchestra has gotten, the more administrative work there is to do. And so it's become more than a full-time job. I don't love doing administration. I'm really looking forward to not doing that. I'm hoping they'll at some point ask me back as an emeritus conductor and that I can just do that. And, of course, I'm very happy to consult with the board about any of it, to a degree, you know. So I'm actually really happy to turn it over. I feel like 18 is, kind of the age you launch a child.
True. And your child is, this child is ready to go.
Yeah, and I have other music projects that I want to do. I'm dying to travel, and travel is very limited by our season
schedules. And so when you were talking about taking your first conducting classes and how that represented to you or showed
you,
that this was your life. Have you kept that sense of, fulfillment through the 18 years of conducting?
No question about it. The thing about conducting, studying scores, it takes a tremendous amount of study. It's the good part about my personality is that I'm kind of divided between being an introvert and an extrovert. So I love socializing, but I also need a lot of time alone. And studying scores, learning the music, there's so many aspects to it. It's a little hard to describe, but it's such a deep endeavor that it's a never-ending learning experience. Never ending.
You can keep getting better and better.
And it's not just that you keep getting better and better, but that your ears expand, you begin to hear, for example, how sounds go together. What's a trombone sound like with a first violin? What does an oboe and a clarinet sound like together? It's like a gigantic, when you're with the orchestra, it's like a gigantic relief map of sound. And you're kind of the eagle flying over it, or the hawk or something, maybe the pigeon. So you are able to more and more, as your experience allows you, both to integrate those sounds and also to determine what sounds are not correct or not right, don't sound together, or you know, something's too loud, balance. There are so many aspects of sound, sound production. How do you want the violins to sound? Like, where do you want them on the bow? And all of this comes with more and more experience. So it is absolutely a never-ending pursuit. It really, truly is. And I think that's why most conductors don't retire. But I'm about to turn 70. I'm ready to retire.
Well, as you said, a nice thing would be to be invited back as a guest conductor.
Yeah.
Or invited to other places as a guest conductor.
Yeah, we'll see if that happens.
Yeah. Something to maybe look forward to it.
Yeah. But if it doesn't happen, that's okay, too.
So I think one of the threads that we left behind is that you were studying guitar at some point, but now I see you as a cellist when you perform.
Yeah.
How did you make that?
It's not a transition. It's kind of an embarrassing story. I was living on the farm in Vermont, and the Vermont Symphony was featuring a friend of mine from Putney. I lived on the other side of the state, but somebody I knew from Putney was playing cello with the orchestra, and he was really cute.
Oh, a romantic story.
So, I'm watching him playing cello up there, and I'm like, I want to do that. So I didn't have a telephone. We didn't have a telephone by choice, actually. But there was a shopping paper. So I put an ad in the shopping paper looking for a cello, and people would write me these notes. Oh, I have a cello in the attic. My husband used to play. The cello that I bought for $25, including the bow, was a turn of the century or early 1900s cello. You know, great cello. I mean, not fantastic, but a good cello. And and I bought it for $25, eventually sold it for $7,000, and got my present cello. So during that time, I was playing piano, I was playing some guitar, I was playing cello, and just playing. You know, it's all music.
Did you take lessons on the cello?
I did.
Or yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the reason that popped back in my mind is that I'm thinking in your retirement or your next career that you'll continue to perform, perhaps?
I don't care so much about performing. I actually still play a tremendous amount of music. I have a string quartet that I play with every couple of weeks. I play piano and cello duets once a week with somebody I've played with for 20 years. I play gypsy jazz once a month down at the Taste of Rome with Hot Club of Marin. I like all kinds of music. I like playing. I'm playing with a bunch of bluegrass people on Sunday. The cello is really a versatile instrument, so that's terrific. I can play bass on it, but I can also. So that's definitely going to continue. Maybe I'll join an orchestra. Who knows? I don't know. Be interesting.
Are you making a distinction between playing and performing?
I don't really care about. I just don't care about performing. And I love performing as a conductor. I really love it. I love talking to the audience. I love everything about it. But I don't really love playing. I don't love performing on cello. I mean, I do it once a month, but you know, I just don't care about
So the difference is having an audience appreciate it as opposed to
just having an
audience,
yourself. You know, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, I get that, I think. It's been an hour.
Right.
Do you feel like stopping or do you want to say anything about Mill Valley and how it's changed?
I'll say a few words about Mill Valley
and
how it's changed.
And then anything else that you think we missed that you would like to have in this?
Yeah, or anything else you want to ask me, I'm happy to answer. It's been really interesting watching how Mill Valley has changed, and not particularly in a happy way. In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. But as I mentioned before, when we first moved here, there were a lot of musicians here. Then the 80s came, the musicians could not afford to be here. And they couldn't afford to buy their parents' houses, even. And then, you know, dual income couples started coming in. There was a lot that changed. One thing I found really distressing was that people who lived in Mill Valley proper when my son was in school felt that they didn't want their children to come down to Tam Valley because it was the other side of the tracks. That's pretty amazing to me. Parents became more and more protective. Like, my son was going into the city on the bus on his own. Fine. You know, like, that's kind of my heritage, right? My legacy, I should say. Mm-hmm. It just got more and more homogenous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, architecturally lost a lot of character. There are a lot of developments that went in that also negatively affected the character of the village. Mm-hmm. That's not to say Mill Valley, I think, should have grown, but I think it also should have grown more in the direction of low-income housing instead of mega mansions and private schools. I mean, that it just really have very, very negative feelings about that. Mm-hmm. But I would say the good thing about Mill Valley that I really like, I mean, there are a lot of good things that I like. I love my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of us that hang out, neighbors that hang out in the park around the corner from me with our dogs every morning. And it's a real spectrum of people, which I love. One of the things that I really like about Mill Valley is that we have 5 major presenting arts organizations. We have the O.T. Hamlin Center, Mill Valley Philharmonic, the Throckmorton Sweetwater Marin Theater Company. That is amazing.
Yes.
So I really like that about mm-hmm. our town. Mm-hmm. And I like a lot of people here.
Right. And it seems like there are artists and musicians. They're just not maybe as visible, right?
I mean, they're not invisible.
They're not visible. I mean, I don't know who they all are. You see them maybe at a show or at a or at a concert, but I think they're in our midst.
I think they're in our midst, but I think there's enough of a concentration of wealth in Mill Valley that would only allow for artists of wealth.
That might be.
And that's, you know, kind of a drag.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
will that drive you away to another community?
Well, nothing's going to drive me away because I have this incredible place that I partially built myself, and mm-hmm. It's got a great big garden, and it's really, really peaceful. Mm-hmm. I can't ever see myself selling that place. It's really a gem. Mm.
How nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very cabin.
Yeah. And if I recall where your neighborhood is, it's remote, let's say.
It
you're
is.
Not
it's
on the way to anywhere.
No, it's kind of the hidden neighborhood,
yeah.
Which is great. Uh-huh. I mean, we're off of the way to Muir Woods, yeah. And so the weekends make it It's almost impossible to get in and out of my neighborhood, but
as long as you time your escapes, right, around the beach traffic. Yeah. Well, okay. Can you think of anything else that we should add to this wonderful
I don't think so.
Description? Thank you so much.
Thank you for interviewing
me.
Yeah,
it was great to hear how your story unfolded. You're a good storyteller, too, in addition to your many,
thank you.
Many skills.
That's quite a compliment. Thank you.